Hi, everybody. I want to welcome you guys again to Thursday Night Parsha Share. Next week, Dr. David Berger is giving Parsha Share, and the week after that, Rabbi Naftali Hartzler. That will cover us till the end of June. I'd like to thank again Mrs. Kahan. I lost count. I'm not sure if it's three or two or four. But whatever it is, I thank you for your annual, our annual opportunity to hear your Torah. And without further ado, Mrs. Kahan.
Thank you so much for joining me tonight. I wanted to talk in this week's Parsha to discuss a certain dynamic that takes place that's really a manifestation of a phenomenon that takes place throughout Tanakh, where we see ways in which different characters either manifest a character trait that's associated with their family or manifest some kind of permutation or break from that character trait, and how that sort of drives the story. So we'll start by looking at an example in our Parsha, in Parshat Korach, and then we'll see a few other examples in Tanakh, and then come back to Parshat Korach. Okay, so the first example, one of the ones that I think is the most interesting in Tanakh, actually, of this idea of hereditary family qualities that manifest in different ways in different stories, is in the personality of Korach himself. So if we look at the first source from Bamidbar Tet Zayin, these are some famous psukim that are paralleled in the Haftarah. It says, "Vayishlach Moshe l'kor l'dasan l'aviram b'nei aliyah v'yomru lo na'aleh, ha'ma'ad k'yelitani meretz avat chalaz v'vash, l'amitinu b'minbar k'istarer l'inu gan t'istarer." It says, "Dasan l'aviram refused to come." And then the Moshe responds in Pasuk Tedvav, "Vayichar l'moshe ma'od," he became very upset, very hurt, is the way Rashi describes it. "Vayomer al Hashem al teifen al menchatam lo machor chamor echad mehem nasati v'lo hariyoti et echad mehem." It's a very personal response where he clearly seems to feel that they are impugning his own integrity. And he responds by saying that, proclaiming his innocence, his integrity, and explaining, "I've never even taken one donkey from them. I never did bad to any of them." And as we know, these are the psukim that are paralleled in the Haftarah that Shmuel says when he is, that Shmuel says when he is upset with people for asking for a king, and he doesn't understand, he seems to also sort of take it personally that they're turning against his model of leadership. And he says in Pasuk Gimel, "Hinani anu bi meged Hashem b'meged Mashiach," like, "Testify against me. Tell me if it's true. Et shor mi lakachti v'chamor mi lakachti, that mi ashakti et mi ratzoti mi an mi lakachti kofer v'ali meinai bo v'ashi lachem." It says, "Did I ever appease anyone or act unjustly? And if so, I'll make it back to them now." So as we know, I believe it's a Gemara in Megillah, it's quoted by Rashi here, that Korach was an ancestor of Shmuel. "Ra'al shel shelet gedola yotza mimenu, Shmuel sheshakul k'neged Moshe v'Aaron, amar b'shvilo ani nimat." So he thought that because Shmuel was going to come from him, that would be enough of a split that he would be, that he, Korach, would be safe. So Korach is an ancestor of Shmuel. And what I think is so interesting about these particular psukim is that they sort of reflect Shmuel as Moshe Korach, right? A combination of the two of them. In the sense that on the one hand, Shmuel sounds somewhat like Korach in that he is, he's sort of protesting the idea of a centralized authority in the way that Korach protested the authority of Moshe and Aaron. He is also saying he's rejecting the idea of a king. So in that sense, he sort of has this Korach quality to him. On the other hand, clearly he's very much in Moshe's camp, right? He believes in Torah Moshe Rabbeinu, and he actually uses Moshe's words, right? So he's sort of and he's actually, what he's saying is, don't take a king, just listen to the Torah, listen to the Torah of Moshe, right? So he's sort of that Korach, a little bit of that orientation of being suspicious of power and corruption and centralized leadership. On the other hand, very much believing in Moshe and Moshe's Torah and Moshe's authority, and even using Moshe's words, right? And in fact, the Ramban points out that Moshe's words seem to indicate that Moshe is more righteous than what a melech would have rights to be, according to Shmuel, right? Because in the next source from Shmuel Parakhet, Shmuel says that what a king would typically do is take people's chamolim and take their animals and take maaser from their flocks. And the Ramban points out on Parshat Korach that when Moshe says, "V'tam lo chamorachan mehem nasati, amar masrara ani mistarer lehem," like, how could you say that I'm exalting myself over them or taking some kind of srara? "Ki me olam lo lakachti mehem afilu chamorachad," I never even took one donkey from them. So it's our kai kiderachim lachim al hasarim. He said, "Mishpat Hamelucha," which is the Mishpat Hamelucha. A person would be, a king would be entitled to do that, like Shmuel says, "Dichtiv Shmuel Aleph Parakhet." "Ve'et Hamorechem Yikach Asa Ulimalachto." Okay, so what's so interesting about this is Shmuel is sort of manifesting a quality of that we associate with Korach, of this this sort of suspicion of centralized authority. At the same time, very much aligning himself with Moshe as a leader, and even vindicating Moshe with his own words, because his own words harken back to Moshe, and he's sort of channeling Moshe, and harken back to Moshe's words that prove what a righteous leader he was, that he didn't even do what a king would be entitled to do. Okay? Any comments or questions on that so far? So it seems like the Parsha starts off with this, sort of gets us started with this idea that's like this fascinating idea of a personal quality that's handed down over the generations and that takes various permutations in different people. Okay? And that's sort of where we start. And the whole idea of Machloket Korach comes from that concern for centralized authority, which later is manifest in Shmuel in a very different light. Okay, just to explore this idea some more, I want to look at two examples from elsewhere in Tanakh. Now, we of course, we're familiar with various examples of this that are very well known, right? Like Eliyahu Pinchas, Rachel, Shaul, Esther. There are a lot of different examples. We're not going to look at those. I'm going to look at a couple that I think are a little bit less well known to explore different ways that this concept comes out in Tanakh. And then we'll return to another example in Parshat Korach. Okay? So, next example I want to look at has to do with the story of Dinah and Shechem. This is an idea, actually, of the Lubavitcher Rebbe that he said in a sicha that I learned many years ago. And he starts by focusing on the very first pasuk of the story of Dinah and Shechem. "Vatetzei Dinah bat Leah, asher yalda liyakov lirot bivnot haaretz." So we're familiar with Rashi on that pasuk, who says, "Bat Leah, velo bat Yaakov, aval ella al shem yisiyata nikri bat Leah." She was called bat Leah instead of bat Yaakov, because she went out, she'afhi yatzanit haita, that she too, Leah, and both Leah and Dinah were like women who go out. She'ne'emar v'tetzei Leah likrato, just like it says in the story when Leah goes out to meet Yaakov, that she also went out to meet him. So yatzanit in this context does not have a positive connotation, right? It doesn't just mean going out. It tends to mean like going out in an inappropriate way, sort of implying promiscuity. It seems to be very negative Rashi, in a very negative perspective on Dinah's actions. But what the Lubavitcher Rebbe pointed out is that in his perspective, in his interpretation, it can't just be that. Because Rashi on Leah's going out says something very positive. The next Rashi, on Rishit Perek Laman, "V'yishma Elokim al Leah, shahaita mitzvah lehavot shvakim." That when Leah went out, it was all very praiseworthy because what she wanted was to increase the Shvatim. She wanted to help build Bnei Yisrael. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe makes this very interesting deal on Rashi, where he says that even though we would tend to read Rashi, the simple reading seems to be that Dinah was doing something inappropriate. Rashi can't really be implying that because he's choosing to compare that pasuk and draw a parallel to Leah, where Rashi himself says that it was very positive that she went out. So he thinks that Rashi must be implying that there was actually also a positive association with Dinah's decision to go out and rope Ibn al-Ha'aretz in the story of Shechem. So in order to understand the positive association, the personal quality that the Lubavitcher Rebbe associated with both Dinah and Leah, I want to look at the next source, the Midrash from Bereishis Rabba, that tells the famous story about when Laban tricked Yaakov into marrying Leah. So we're just going to read parts of it. I left out a lot of the midrash, but it says, "Vayasuf Laban es kol anshei hamakom v'yasem eshtek hines kol anshei mikoma amar lahem yodim atem shehayinu tzachukim l'mayim v'kevon shebah tzadik hazeh l'kan nisbarchu l'mayim amri l'mei ma'ahani lach." So Laban gathered all the people of his city, and he said, you know, we used to need water, and then when the tzadik Yaakov came, we got water, and so we need to figure out a way to keep him here. And they said, okay, what can we do for you? So the Midrash tells a whole story about that. And then Biram Sha'atun Malta, the Chafin Butsunaya. So at night, after the wedding, everyone turned out the lights. And Yaakov said, "What are you doing?" So they said, "Do you think that we're like immodest like you?" And so that night he called her Rachel and she answered him. And in the morning he saw that she was Leah. You're such a trickster, the daughter of a trickster. Didn't I call you Rachel last night? You answered me. Amr le isaper de lace le talmidim lo kach habatavach lachavuch esa v'ad anulay. But she said, is there a barber who doesn't have students, like who learned to cut hair the same way he does? Didn't your father call you Esav? And you answered him. I said, it's a fascinating midrash. We know we're familiar with the story of the midrash, but we don't always see it inside like this. So what qualities do you think we see in Leah from this like incredible answer she gives him? Right? When I learned this with some of my students in Mayano, they're like very taken aback that she would speak that way. Right? What are you talking to me about, right? Didn't your father call you Esav and you answered him? So what kind of like personality or like approach are we seeing in Leah through the eyes of this midrash? How would you describe it?
She knows about
that. Stands up for herself. What'd you say?
I mean, she understands family dynamics. That in families, you know, parents call their children by other children's names. In our family too.
I was in my family also. Right, and she certainly stands up. So she's not sort of apologetic. She recognizes she's pragmatic like that. She stands up for herself. Yeah.
I think she's saying, you do what you've got to do.
Yeah.
To get where you need to get to.
Right. Unapologetic. Exactly. I mean, she's completely unapologetic. She's just willing to say, like, give me a break. You know, and I know that sometimes you have two not great options. And you make a choice, and you do the one that seems the best in that particular situation. So, like, give me a break. We both did the same thing. That's really what she's saying here. So that kind of personality of being sort of very assertive and pragmatic and willing to take action and not being intimidated by people is the quality that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, he doesn't quote this midrash specifically, but I think it represents it, that he associates with both Dina and Leah. In fact, he says that the famous Rashi based on the Midrash that they would say, you know, Esav will marry Leah and Yaakov will marry Rachel because the older, the younger. So he says that the idea of that Midrash wasn't just older to older, younger to younger, but that like Leah would have been a good shit up for Esav. Like she would have been able to stand up to him. She would have been able to have an influence on him. That's what he thinks the deeper meaning of that Midrash is. Like it actually, she was the one person who could have handled Esav. And so he says that when Dina goes out, she's sort of manifesting this same type of personality, like really wanting to have an influence on others, not just staying at home, wanting to lirot bivnot ha'aretz and have an impact on society and be an assertive person. And in fact, he says that this very, that in a sort of like twisted way, she actually does have an incredibly profound impact on the society around her, and that Shlem, technically, converts before they are all killed. So he said, like, it's obviously not what she had in mind when she went lirot bivnot ha'aretz, but the fact is in the next source, like, they were so sort of taken with her, right, and impacted by her, that they all had a bris milah before they died. So he says this is sort of an example of how that quality was even more so in Dina than in Leah, that they shared it, but there was an even stronger manifestation in Dina, in that she didn't shy away from it. Like Leah, according to his interpretation, had Ena Leah Rakos. She avoided it. She cried. She didn't want to marry Esav. She didn't want to deal with all that. And Dina had that same quality, but actually embraced it. She went out and she wanted to have that impact on society, wanted to engage in that way, and ended up having a more far reaching impact than Leah did. That's the way he reads it. Yes?
I think one of the things that the Rebbe is saying is, put in modern terminology, is you don't blame the victim.
Mm-hmm.
She was a victim, and don't blame the victim. The whole idea that she caused it upon herself is just not socially acceptable these days.
Right.
And even I think the Rebbe was basically saying that it's not her fault.
Right, exactly.
But after her, it was not her fault.
Right, absolutely. So it's a much more appealing way to read that Rashi. And he really says that the Yeropiv note Ha'aretz is like she was trying to do Kirov, right? She was like, it was very appropriate. It doesn't say that she was trying to do anything bad. So this is an example of that same type of idea, according again to a certain interpretation that we saw with Korach and Shmuel, of a certain personality trait that manifests in different ways but runs very strongly in a family. Remember when I learned this sicha, it was when I was in Israel for the year, like 20-something years ago, and I happened to be learning at the time with a chavrusa who had lost her mother when she was 3. And she had always had this, like, a lot of pain about that, and in part because she sort of felt like her siblings were older, they sort of knew her mother more, she felt almost like she didn't have as authentic a relationship with her mother. And I remember the sicha actually gave her a lot of nechama. She mentioned it to me just recently again, in feeling that, like, maybe there's, like, something of my mother that's in me also, and maybe even more so. Like, that idea that there's something so intrinsic and, like, a quality that's really part of a family that can be part of a person without their even realizing it. I just remember that being, like, a very impactful experience. Okay, I'll look at one more example and then come back to our parsha. So the next example I want to look at is the story of the family of the Benot Lot, who ultimately had as a descendant Ruth. Okay, so there are some interesting parallels between the stories of the Benot Lot and of Ruth. Now, obviously, we think of the Benot Lot as having done something very terrible and completely inappropriate in any society. But at the same time, what's interesting is to see the ways in which their actions in the eyes of Tanakh are really parallel to someone that we see as a true heroine. So in both stories, I made a table here. Both stories begin with a family that experiences destruction, loss of loved ones, and then escapes that, right? So in the story of the Benot Lot, first the Lot's wife, if you read the pasuk to mean that she turned around and became a pillar of salt, which is the machlokas rishonim, but that's, if you read it that way, right? So Vatabet ishto me'achara vatahin netziv melach, she turns around, she becomes a pillar of salt. And then Vayhi b'shachit Elokim et arei hakikar, so then Hashem destroys the whole city and Lot escapes. In the story of Ruth, it's not that kind of dramatic destruction, but similarly, they lose many people who are close to them, lose 3 people, and then they escape from this place of famine after having experienced that personal loss. Both of them, I think this is the most striking similarity, is they clearly have, like, this feeling of despair about whether they'll have any continuity, whether they'll have any family legacy. So in the story of the Benot Lot, the Tomer have a fear of Tzira, and so she says, Avinu zakein b'ish ein ba'aretz v'avo alein v'terech kol ha'aretz. So there's no one left. We're never going to be able to get married. We're never going to be able to have children. And the same kind of emotion is experienced by Ruth in the story of Naomi, Naomi and Ruth, when Naomi says to Ruth, you should go back, shovna benotai, lama teilachna acharai, ha'ud libanim b'me'ai v'hayu lachem la'anashim. I don't have anyone left to give you. I have no sons left to give you. You're never going to get married if you come with me. You're never going to have a family. You're not going to have continuity. In both stories, the turning point, the sort of resolution, comes through this unusual sort of surprise encounter in both cases that involve the male protagonist drinking. And, you know, they're not the same story. They're not, you know, it's not the same thing that happens in both, but they do both have this sort of unusual encounter at night where the man is sort of not knowing what's going on. And that's the next piece. And then finally, both stories conclude with a genealogy that brings us forward to that legacy that gave them so much despair at the start of the story. So with the Benot Lot, we're told that they gave birth to Moab, and that this was a real legacy, that it continues. Huavi Moab ad hayom. And the Tzi'ira also gives birth, and she gives birth to Amon ad hayom. There's, like, a legacy that continues, that really goes on. And similarly, in the story of Ruth, where the Sefer ends with a genealogy that tells us how Chashav this family became, that there was a real legacy that continued. Vatikrena shmo Obad, hu Abi Yishai, Abi David. Okay? So it seems like these are some interesting parallels, maybe. But it's sort of okay, they're parallels. It doesn't seem so much like a personal quality. But what I think that we can read the stories as representing, like, a real creativity and courage and resourcefulness on the part of these characters in Tanakh, of the Benot Lot and Ruth. So we'll look together at the source from the Rav that comes next, from Abraham's Journey, this very famous read on Lot's daughters that I just always find incredibly moving and impactful. He said, Lot's daughter had something beautiful to contribute to the emerging personality of the King Mashiach. What did this primitive girl possess that the Almighty, gathering virtues and noble traits from all over the world, picked up? She was uncouth and primitive. She committed incest. and yet she was the great-great-grandmother of Ruth. The Messiah will be her descendant. She was under the impression that a cosmic cataclysm had struck and only three human beings had survived. Years ago, we were unable to imagine this, but now we understand that it is something that can happen any day. She acted as she did because she wanted to save humanity. This girl wanted to rebuild the world, to start from scratch, and raise another race to take the place of the human race, which she believed had been destroyed simultaneously with the destruction of Sodom. This was heroism of an undreamt caliber. Instead of giving up, she had the courage to try to rebuild the world, to make a new humanity arise from the ashes of Sodom. Okay? I think we need to read the rest of the source, but what the Rav does here is he sort of notes this parallel, maybe, he doesn't mention it, but he may be thinking about it, I'm not sure, but makes it clear that this is not just like a story, and it's not just a parallelism between stories, it represents a personal quality of this like incredible courage and creativity in the face of destruction. That's how he reads the story of the Benos Lot. And I think certainly that's how instinctively we would read the story of Ruth. Okay? So we've seen these three examples so far: Korach, Shmuel, the Lubavitcher Rebbe's reading of Dina and Leah, the Rav's reading of the Benos Lot, and comparing that to Ruth. Now I want to return to one more personality in our parsha. So we mentioned that at the beginning of the parsha, we began the story with this interesting permutation of the anti-authoritarian personality that's represented by Korach and later in a very different way by Shmuel. What's interesting is that the parsha is also resolved through the efforts of someone who is an interesting manifestation of his own family's personal qualities, and that is Aaron. Right? Aaron is really the person who resolves the story of this parsha. We sometimes talk about we learn about the nisim of the earth and the fire swallowing every now, but really what stops the plague and what resolves the entire story of Parashat Korach is Aaron in two different ways, right? Aaron stops the Magifa by bringing the Ketoret, and Aaron's staff, when it flowers, is this beautiful miracle that puts everyone's anxiety to rest and lets everyone move on and resolves the story. So what's interesting is Aaron, on the one hand, we consider him sort of the quintessential Levi. He represents Levi in this parsha. He represents the Kohuna and the Levia throughout the parsha. And at the same time, he's actually very different from how we think about Shevet Levi, from the qualities that we generally associate with them, right? So on the one hand, he's similar in that he's invested in teaching and impacting others and being sort of a light within the nation. On the other hand, he's not at all, like his entire personality, some of you have started doing that recently, I find it so interesting, his entire personality is like the opposite of the sort of zealousness that we associate with Shevet Levi, right? So for example, if we look at if we think about some of the most pivotal moments in our own story, they're like the opposite of what we usually associate with Shevet Levi. So in the first case is in our Parsha, not the first chronologically, but the first we'll look at is in our Parsha, where he runs and he stops the V'yamod bein hametim uvein achayim batei atzar hamageifa, right? And then he brings the Matei Aaron, and it's a mishmeret lo'od livnei meri, becomes this, so that lo yamutu, right? He keeps standing up so that the people won't experience severe punishment. Whereas the stories that we associate with Levi are the stories that we looked at earlier in the Parsha, right? Or, no, actually, here I give you, we'll look at that next. It's the story of the Eagle, right? When they were the ones who were willing to turn against everyone, and they were willing to stand against their own families and take their swords and go kill everyone who had sinned. It's like the opposite. He's like running to stop the death and the punishment. And one of the quintessential stories of Levi is in the Eagle, where they're like the ones. What makes them so special, what makes them be chosen, is that they were willing to inflict the punishment. Okay, and the next source, one of the other famous stories about Aaron is at the Egel, where, this is the way Chazal read it, his entire motivation is Musaf Shidlav Bihar Sirachon Velo BiYisrael, that he wanted to save them by having the blame placed on him and not on Yisrael. And he was willing to sort of, he was like very non-confrontational, willing to take any kinds of steps to push off the sin so that everything would fall on him and so that B'nai Yisrael wouldn't be punished. And that is, like, again, exactly the opposite of the kind of action that we talked about earlier in the parsha in Shlem, when Levi and Shimon are so zealous and vayomru hachazona yaaset achoshenu, they're willing to stand up and kill an entire city out of this kind of pride and jealousy on behalf of their sister. And in Dibre Chazal also, one of the most famous like images that we have of Aaron is in the next midrash from the Abbas Rabbi Nasser, and the whole like series of midrashim like this about Aaron, that the way that he operated is that he would be going on the way and he would meet someone and he would be nice to him and he would notem lo shalom, and the next day that guy would want to do an avera and he would say, how could I ever look Aaron in the face again? He was so nice to me yesterday, so I'm not going to do this avera. It was in this incredibly gentle way, which is, again, in contrast to the quality that we associate with Shimon and Levi from the Birkot Yaakov, where he makes it sound like that's exactly the opposite. Like, I have the Afitzim B'Yisrael to keep them apart from each other because they're so sort of Kanayish, right? And they're not the type of people who are just trying to influence people in, like, a positive sort of passive way. Okay, so I think that it's interesting to consider that while that these two personalities, right, the personality of Korach and the personality of Aaron, both represent a quality that's associated with their family in some way, but like in one case, you know, a permutation that really embraces that quality, and in another, it seems like Aaron is like really purposely taking a stand against that. Like he's committed to the idea of teaching and influencing others and leading, which is associated with Shevet Levi, that it almost seems like he's defining himself in contrast to that quality. By taking like exactly, this is the prototype of exactly the opposite approach that we typically associate with Shevet Levi. And that's really what brings resolution to the story of the Parsha. Okay, thoughts so far, questions? Okay, so I want to think for a moment about why this is such an influential dynamic in Tanakh. I mean, it's really like everywhere. It's like almost every important person you can think about in Tanakh, you could somehow think about them in contrast or as a continuation of their family quality and characteristic. And I think it really has to do with the idea that, you know, when I teach in high school, for example, it's not at all surprising to my students that people are individuals and that Tanakh recognizes that. It's one of the most powerful things about Tanakh that I find in learning Tanakh, the idea that like Tanakh really recognizes the greatness of the individual and really like is so open to individuality. And like, for example, if you think about stories of loss in Tanakh or any sort of human experience in Tanakh, the way that every single person experiences it in Tanakh is completely different from every other one. One of the most sort of life-affirming ideas that I like have ever learned about Tanakh is the idea that if you look at every single person who experiences a tragedy in Tanakh, there are no two that are at all similar. That's incredible, right? That's beautiful and amazing. And it really shows how much Tanakh recognizes and appreciates and respects individuality and the greatness of the individual. But that's almost like not even surprising to us in our society, right? What Tanakh also recognizes is that people also need roots, right? People also need to come from someplace and know that they came from someplace, right? Like the story of my friend who had lost her mother, like that's also really important, not just to feel like the whole world is open to me and I could be anything, but to also feel like I have a background, I have roots, I have something that's like part of me, whether I want it to be or not. And I think that that combination of believing both of those things about man, that's like very hard to do, right? That is not so, it's just not so simple. It's not so intuitive. It's very hard to manifest that in our relationships with each other or in the way we think about ourselves. But they're both so incredibly important in just a healthy perspective on life and on oneself. And I really think that that could be why this is such an important dynamic in Tanakh of these family. It's not just like interesting parallels and like making connections. It's like a really deep-seated belief about people, that people come from someplace, people are something innately, and people also have infinite possibility to change that, right? Or to define what that means for them. And so that's why we see in these examples, there are some people who just manifest the quality that they're born with. There are some, let's say, Dina and Leia that way, maybe. There are some people who manifest the quality, but different, very different permutations, right? So like Shmuel and Korach, who have a certain bent with when it comes to authority, but really manifest it in different ways and have different beliefs about authority and different beliefs about Moshe Rabbeinu specifically. And then there are people like this example of Aaron and Shevet Levi, where there's like a real break, not a complete break. Aaron, again, you know, embraces the values of Shevet Levi teaching and things like that, but also really seems to almost like define himself in contrast to some of the qualities of Shevet Levi. But in each case, it's that dynamic at play, that dynamic of having roots and also having a lot of free choice and individuality. And I think that by sort of tracing personalities through Tanakh that way, We see that Tanakh really believes that about people and wants to make that so clear to us, right? Wants to really manifest this in the characters that are described in Tanakh, because it's an important belief for us also, not just something that was, that's important to understand about the people in Tanakh. And so to me, that idea that just in this week's parasha, we see two very different permutations of that, and that it's also a dynamic that runs throughout so much of Tanakh, it's like a really important way to think about both the characters that we learn about Tanakh and also about who we are. And I was thinking, especially, you know, didn't even think about this when I agreed to give this year, but it happened to be Father's Day this weekend. And I always like sort of like think about that when it comes to Mother's Day and Father's Day, like thinking about what are those qualities in our own lives, in our own families that exist, that we sort of, that are just make us who we are, and that are our roots, that sort of form the backdrop against which we make our own decisions about our own lives and our own personalities. Thank you for joining me. Any questions? Yeah,
please. How do you read Pinchas then, Aaron's grandson?
Right, so it's interesting. So he's more of that, like, Tanayish personality. I think you're right. I think there is that, you know, different people in that line make different choices about that. They share a commitment. It's not like Chaplin's bad. Or, you know, that's not the fact. I sort of think of, this is becoming very personal, but I sort of think my grandfather was like, always talked about how, like, his parents and how there were certain, like, values he really appreciated in certain ways that he really lived his life differently. You know, and I think we sort of see that in those characters.
Pinchas gets the bris of Shalom. Right, so even within Pinchas, you sort of have this dynamic where on the one hand he's a Kenai, on the other hand he gets a bris of Shalom. So, you know, it's like a descendant of Aaron, but at the same time, arguably the opposite.
Maybe who's Aaron's wife? Maybe he takes over to the other side. Why are you talking about the father?
True. Okay, well, we see it in some of these. We saw so two women here. Come on. Right, I always think in terms of shidduchim, this is like a different topic, but in terms of marriages and relationships, I always think of like Kalev and Miriam that way, how they have like a lot. I could imagine why they're a good shidduch, right? They're both like very, you know that little, the kid's book, little Miriam, who always, what was it? Who always knew how to stand up, something like that. It wasn't it. Who always something. Anyway, so I could imagine them sort of having that similarity. Now I want to go find the book, so I don't remember what it was. Okay,
thank you very much.
Next week is Dr. David Berger.
That's also, I mean, this parsha is probably.